Hello and welcome to Charity ePulse, your bi-weekly dive into the issues and challenges affecting the charity sector. I'm Charles Mosqueter, Charities Director at Quilter Cheviot, and I'm delighted once again to be joined by my co-host, Catherine Ross-Jomji, Partner and Head of Charities at Shakespeare Martineau, and James Saunders, Charity Partner at Moore Kingston Smith. Together, we explore the latest insights and pressing issues affecting the sector. And don't forget, you can catch us on Spotify, Apple Podcast, and YouTube, as well as our website. Let's get started. Well, there's a lot that's been in the news over the last couple of weeks. I think we're going to start with the budget and charities urging the Chancellor to ease the sector's 1.4 billion national insurance rise. Who'd like to kick off with that one? James.
So I can't find it difficult to believe that this wasn't considered when the new government were throwing about policies on how to raise tax. I mean, employers in IC applies to charities and non-profits as much as anyone else. So it's just an extra cost for them as well. So I'd be surprised if this was a surprise to government that the sector has rallied against it. And in particular, certain subsectors are flagging the inequality of it, notably hospices against their NHS compadres are in a far worse position. It's changing every day. The health secretary has been questioned about, again, I follow the hospices because I've got a few hospice clients. The West Streeting's been questioned about hospices. It says they are considering it and they are thinking about it, but there'll be no blanket bringing hospices into, or exempting them rather, from this increase. And they're looking at the grant, so they're looking to fund it rather than cancel it for them. So yeah, it all seems a bit of a continued muddle, really, and really, really quite depressing, really, that despite all the positive words from government, new government, about covenant and working with the sector and supporting it, the first chance they get to differentiate the sector, they don't take it and they just lump them all in together. It goes against all those warm words.
What about you, Catherine?
I just find it quite incredible. You know, we had all of this during the COVID emergency measures where the charity sector was forgotten and it was overlooked, and that was a mistake and it was an oversight and not deliberate, da 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 da. And as James says, and now we have a new government talking about covenant, talking about how crucial charities are to our modern society, which they are, and then to be hit with 1.4 billion overnight. I know, speaking at a conference this week, and the number of charities there that mentioned this is, you know, that's out of control. Their costs are now beyond their reach. And it's something that just, you know, you couldn't plan for, you couldn't predict. So I think, you know, again, we'll see NHS versus health and social care charities, and they're in a slightly different bubble. But I think for all other charities, it's not looking like they're going to be getting a grant from government. And I can't really see how the government can square that, as, you know, all good feeling, as you say, is definitely gone out of the window at this point.
Yeah, and you've got it on top of the national living or minimum wage going up by a huge amount, which will affect the sector. So this is a double whammy. And you do just think, you know, they've got one thing. Is it the covenant or the compact? I can't remember that we've got coming, and government going to have a different change to that relationship with the sector. And then suddenly you hit them, and you just know full well that any of the contracts that charities have got, where they're already having to subsidise government, that they're not going to have more money to make up for that difference. I agree with you. And of course, on top of that, I then spotted that the government, which I think was HMRC, published plans to stop charities from obtaining tax relief in ways that aren't intended. And that comes, I think we talked about this a year or so ago in the consultation. James, what's your viewpoint on that?
Yeah, it's a shame, a continued shame, I think, that consultation, as we said, probably, I mean, it might be best part of a year ago, but we said at the time, it seemed to be focused, you know, on how to stop a tiny minority of charities abusing the gift aid scheme or tax relief schemes rather than how to make it better or raise more money, or four points. Three of them were how to stop the fraud, the minimum amount of fraud that goes on, and one point about how to make things easier. It really, I really, really, it took enormous umbrage at one statement, which was charities continue to not submit tax returns when asked to do so. It makes my blood boil because I see this firsthand, and a single letter from HMRC to a charity's address, which is out of date by years, is not reasonable communication. And to try and lay that at the door of charities not being prepared to submit information. Every charity I work with is scared stiff of HMRC and falling foul of not submitting tax returns. It costs an enormous. I'll reiterate this. We've had clients in the last 6 months receive backdated claims from HMRC for 2019, 2020, 2021 year ends, tax assessed on the top line income of the entity's accounts. Your income was 20 million pounds. The tax you need to pay us is 5 million pounds, and it scares the living daylights out of charity finance managers who suddenly get this. Is it a scam? Is it real? Do we really owe people 5 million? No, it's easily. It's not. I don't mean easily. It is resolvable by submitting a tax return. And then you get the letter saying, "Oh, it's all okay. No tax, no fines, no penalties. Brilliant." But that worry in between is ridiculous. And of course, every time the charity has to engage its accountants to prepare those returns, there's money in fees, I'm afraid. There's nothing is free these days. So it's a lot of time and money wasted for zero tax and zero effect. And yet they have the nerve to say, charities don't refuse to return to make tax returns. It makes my blood boil. That's me channeling my inner Charles Mosquito there.
Did you am I right in thinking you don't have to fill in a tax return every year, do you? They just periodically send it to
Well,
test.
again, a charity that is a company should, because it is a company. So it's when
Okay.
it's set up, it's registered fundamentally. The HMRC's position, of course, is that they will allow charities at their discretion, if they're sorry, companies who are charities, to not submit a tax return, but it is by exemption. It is by exception. Now, that does mean that a charity that is long established and has no trading subsidiary and hasn't got anything complex and doesn't hit any of the algorithm ticks means you can go for years and decades without having to submit a tax return. So it can get missed very easily. And that's why I say in some cases the charity address might be just years out of date. So that single letter that goes off doesn't get to the right place. And then the first you hear of it is a tax return to the agents, a letter to the agent saying, by the way, your client has not submitted a tax return. Here's the tax and penalty.
I must admit, the first time I ever was faced with it was admittedly about 15 years ago. I turned around and said, "What the hell?" I rang up HMRC and said, "We're a charity. Why the hell should I be filling this in?" One. And the second thing was that this isn't actually inappropriate for a charity because I was struggling to fill it in because it had been designed for a private individual or a company. I mean, the thing was nuts. I don't know, Catherine, if you've had a viewpoint on this.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen clients, the shock of receiving an HMRC letter, the fear of God goes through them. So, as you say, James, to say that they're refusing to engage is absolutely incorrect. But it also just the timing of it, the tone of it, we're talking about national insurance increases and all the challenges for charities, and that gift aid is quite a low take up, isn't it? They were talking about there's a whole missing piece there about charities could be using the gift aid scheme more and are not. And I just think this, it almost feels like an obsession that there is some sort of cohort that are fraudulent in this scheme. Well, there might be some, but it's not the vast, vast, vast majority. And when they know who those people are, then go after them. I find it that we just go round and round the houses to address an issue, and they already know which people are abusing the system and what it is they're doing to manipulate it.
And it
I know
also
these
must
are
be very
charities.
easy to see. It's very easy to see where there's a tax dodge going on with charities. If it's a new charity set up or And there's a, and it's very simple numbers going through the accounts, simple big numbers, you know, the whichever one it was, Citi, I can't remember which what it was from a few years ago. But you know, these are not difficult to see and spot, and I think probably the Charity Commission and HMRC between them spot them quite quickly. It seems to me it's a massive mountain out of a very small molehill.
But you've got, I mean, three things, isn't it? That so CFG, I think, or Charity Finance Group estimates that 560 million of gift aid each year isn't reclaimed. So put that into your perspective of claiming back 20 to 35 million a year. And of course, it's individuals that are trying to game the system. And you're always going to have that, and that's what HMRC is there. But I think, Catherine, you're absolutely right. The feeling you get from HMRC is that they think everybody's trying to cheat them out of money. And you just think, well, hold a second here. These organisations are designed to for the public benefit, and 99.9% of them are doing absolutely what they should be doing. And therefore, you know, shouldn't be treated in this way. Anyway, no doubt we'll come back to this at another later date. The other thing I picked up, Catherine, I think this one's for you, is the tribunal raised a question around whether trustees should be protected as whistleblowers. I have to say, I was a bit confused by all of this.
Yeah, and obviously this is where I have to say to people, I'm not really a useful lawyer because I don't know about employment law, but this case is all to do with whether trustees are workers, which I always think sounds very you know, right on, and yeah, power to the people, whether we are workers or because we're not employees. But the case here related to the British Psychological Society, where one of the trustees did whistleblow. And he was then subject to a disciplinary process and expelled from the society. But he raised allegations of persistent bullying, and it was found that his claims and whether they were protected disclosures weren't treated properly and fairly by the charity. And so the Employment Appeal Tribunal has looked at this, has made the case. And so there's more to come yet, but it's if you were pulling it down, on which side does it fall? It is that trustees are looking at you could potentially fall under you are a worker, albeit that they are unpaid and don't receive any remuneration for it. But I suppose the consequence of that is not, oh, if I'm a worker, does that mean I'm getting paid? It's more, therefore, the trustees would have greater rights and protections under whistleblowing legislation that are not expressly included for them at the moment. So I think there is more to come from this, and I wouldn't claim to understand all the ins and outs of it. I do always like it when they say this is a complex case, and I think, oh, thank goodness, because I didn't necessarily understand every word of what was being said. So you know, there is more to come, but I think for now, let's just watch and wait. So it's all to do with whether trustees could be workers, and if they are, does that then give them whistleblowing protection?
Well, that leads very nicely on to NCVO has claimed that there's a trustee crisis, but not due to whistleblowing, that four in five charities have at least one vacancy and small charities are most effective. Again, I think Catherine, I might start with you here with this one. Are you finding your trustee crisis?
I'm not finding a crisis. You know, when you read a headline like that, and it's almost tempting to slap somebody and say, stop it, you're hysterical. But I think it's not a crisis. Stop saying it's a crisis. If we then had two vacancies, what would that be? A catastrophe? And then everybody would say it's a tsunami because we're all obsessed with elevating this into an issue that it isn't. I think this, it plays against other issues that we see. How do you encourage trustees? How do you thank them for the time and effort they put in? How do we actually receive that help graciously rather than complaining that they're not the correct demographic to be the sort of trustee that we want? And I just didn't think this was an endemic problem. You know, there may well be vacancies. I think charities are always improving the methods in which they are putting out calls for potential trustees, explaining to people what's involved, supporting first-time trustees, all of that I thought could have been a much more positive story than quaking in our boots that we're in a crisis and didn't realise it, perhaps.
James?
Yeah, I agree, actually. And I think, you know, I don't hear many charities closing because they haven't got enough trustees. I hear charities are under threat because they haven't got enough money. I really can't see. I mean, I reckon an awful lot of the survey would have been on, yes, as it says, smaller charities. And smaller charities have always got vacancies. I mean, if you ask a small charity board, have you got enough trustees? Even if they did have enough trustees, they'd say no. You know, that's just the nature of the question of what of the environment. If the mindset's not quite right, but you know, you always want, of course, you always want more trustees and more people to help out on a voluntary organisation. But it's it you know you, that's not what's causing the sector a problem at the moment. And I agree with Catherine. I think this is again it just moving attention away from what the real problems are, which is funding and you know and the other pressures that we've just talked about.
Yeah, I mean, it was interesting, wasn't it? Because in the article, the second part of it was all about lack of representation from younger people, from ethnic minorities and disability. And a bit like you, Catherine, I think we should celebrate those that are trustees at the moment. And we know that the demographics of that isn't necessarily reflecting the society or the communities of which we serve. But there is a definite move towards that, and that takes time to shift. And I agree with you. I think people just need to be possibly a little bit more imaginative. I mean, I go back to my first trusteeship in the village hall and 600 houses. And when I came onto the board, nobody bothered to go around the village and ask anybody would they like to be a trustee and go around. And actually, it didn't take too long to find three or four people who were willing to put their hands up. So I think there are lots of people out there who want to do it. I just think they want to be asked. And so actually, you have to be proactive. And
It's also
also,
worth saying, Charles, you know, charity numbers are increasing. You know, it's, I mean, when all said 2024, Charity Commission received over 9,000 applications to register a charity. Now, yes, as more charities, you know, needs more trustees. Okay, there'll be some dropping out as well at the other end, but you know, there are more and more charities. That doesn't really square with there being a crisis in trustees. But it doesn't. It just doesn't feel right to me. It just doesn't feel like the right subject to be really flagging.
I tell you, the biggest issue I've had with where I'm sitting as a trustee is the number of trustees over the last 10 years that have gone from being retired to actually fully employed, and then trying to find times that suits people for meetings. That has become a
Yeah.
much bigger issue, and something you've just got to sit down with your co-trustees and work out what works for collectively for the board. But the great thing is, of course, is that we can do it, some of it virtual and some of it in person. Although I do think that having everything virtual really doesn't work because you can't develop the relationships with that you need to in the way you need to.
Going back to your previous point as well, Charles, about and Catherine's point about you know the whistleblowing and role the changing role of trustees, that is huge as well. Trustees do are expected to do more and be more knowledgeable, I think, and the pressure on them is more than it's ever been, and that I think is changing the nature of that trustee role as well. So I just yeah, there's a lot of other things that are worth flagging around that, and I just think that simple numbers is a bit of a daft thing to try and focus on.
Have you got anything to add to that, Catherine?
I thought on a positive note, David Holdsworth, Chief Exec of the Charity Commission, put out a blog to tie in with Trustees Week, and I thought how nice that we're hearing the Chief Exec of the Commission be lovely about trustees for a change. And he said, "I wanted to take this opportunity to thank the hundreds of thousands of you in England and Wales who take on this role for the good of others. Thank you from all of us at the Charity Commission and on behalf of all those you make a difference to." And I thought, spot on. That's more of that. Yeah.
What?
And I think, I mean, you had him at the Charity Law Association conference, didn't you? And my impression is that he's very much so taking a positive approach as the new chief executive towards the sector, as to be
Definitely.
fair, is Orlando Fraser, the
Yeah.
chair.
Yeah. Great
Yeah.
combination. Yeah.
No. And something we might flag, because I know that we will cover it up, but we know that the Association of Chairs is going out for consultation around a number of issues around trusteeships, which I think will draw out quite a few of these sorts of points. So something we'll do another podcast in the future. And the final thing I spotted was refusing donations. And this was the Chartered Institute of Fundraising Came out with a statement of about refusing donations due to conflicts that charity's values results in inconsistent decision making. The report suggests. Now, I have to say, I did have to read this about four times to try and work out what they were trying to tell us. Catherine, I know you've had a look at this.
I did have a look at this. I read the article and I thought, I have no idea. I've gone round and round. I have no idea what you're saying. The key point I took away, and probably because I'm governance obsessed, was about it doesn't work interpreting whether you should refuse a donation based on the charity's values, because that's a difficult call for a fundraising officer to make. And my whole issue with that is it is a difficult call. That's why the trustees make it. And they are the ones that adopt a policy about when we do and don't refuse donations. And as we've said before, the Charity Commission are very clear that you should only be refusing donations in exceptional circumstances. So, no, I don't think we should be simplifying this down to the lowest common denominator and letting people just take a view. I thought it's complex for a reason and should be considered at the right level within an organisation. So I just found the piece, I didn't know if I was just not seeing it the way it was intended, but it didn't land for me.
James?
This is an ongoing issue, and it strikes me there's always the different stakeholders in this, in terms of people within a charity and advising on charities, there's a lot of different viewpoints, which means that there's a lot of, it can muddy the waters. And I do think that if you know, there's the legal side, there would be, you know, Charles, you're familiar with the sort of the investment advisory side. And then there's the fundraisers side of the argument. It's very difficult to find the Venn diagram's middle ground in this, I think. Because there are morals and ethics involved. And that does mean that it's a very, as we said before, it's a very personal decision in some of these. And trying to put a blanket criteria onto this is very tricky.
But I don't think, but it shouldn't be personal. That's the whole point. You're meant to be thinking about the charity. No, I can tell you we have lots of conversations, and I use the accepting or rejecting donations actually as a very good starting point for people developing a policy around their investments of what they should and shouldn't be investing in and why. Because there are a number of things that come out of it. One is that these issues are generally very complex. You know, rarely do you have a situation where, you know, if you're a medical research charity, banning investing in tobacco or receiving a donation from a tobacco company, that's really easy, straightforward. It's completely against your objects of your charity. But, you know, where you start getting into working practices and human rights and everything else, these things are really complex. So, I mean, Catherine's absolutely right. The Charity Commission and the law says you shouldn't do it unless exceptional circumstances. And I would challenge you on any circumstances. If you went to your beneficiaries and said, should we refuse this donation? Most of the time they would go, absolutely not. You can do so much good with doing so. And I think we're tying ourselves up in knots over this. Where we should be keeping it at a much simpler level and actually think about the unintended consequences. And just one other thing, you think about the universities that were banning investing in fossil fuels 10, 15 years ago. Of course, what's happened is that those people who had a strong voice have no longer got a voice because they're no longer shareholders. So actually, you've just removed it. So what's happened is these companies have moved into shareholders who are less concerned about such issues, which means that management's under less pressure to do something about it and act responsibly. I mean, I am making slight generalizations, but I do think people need to think about the unintended consequences, and also that actually these aren't moral decisions you're making that on your own personal views.
I know they aren't, but the part of this particular matter was that it's from the fund, it's the CIOF, isn't it, that it's from their perspective, and they have put later on they have said the Charity Commission and the CIOF's own guidance says donation refusals must be based on the charity's objectives rather than personal objections. But then they say it doesn't take account of the fact that the individual fundraiser might have their personal moral obligations. And then it goes into talking about how that's managed. So That was kind of the extra element to it. I know for you, Charles, you're talking about the board's perspective or the trustees' perspective, or even the charity's perspective. But then there are other people. You know, the fundraiser themselves is going to struggle to take away their personal, moral, ethical position from what they're doing, because
But
that's
it's
probably
not.
why they're in the charity. You know, they're working, they're doing their job anyway.
I accept that, but ultimately the trustees are the ones who should be setting the policy and be very clear about
And I think
what it
that
is that's acceptable and not acceptable, not the fundraiser.
I think that's what the guidance does, or this particular coverage does talk about that, but it's pointing out that extra element in there of the personal. But that's why people are in charities. It's not it, very often it's not just another job. There is a calling or a personal involvement in these things. So if you're asking someone to divorce their personal feelings from their job when their job is actually one that they're in because of their personal feelings to an extent, I think that's the dilemma they're really flagging. And I can understand that, except of course, Charles, that the decision making is higher up, is it should be set.
Well, there we are, Catherine. We've had two soapboxes, James and I, on it. Do you want to have the last word?
No. I think I'm going to save myself until I get really irate, and then the two of you won't get a word in at all. But that's a session to come, dear listener. So look forward to that.
Excellent. Well, thank you for tuning in to this episode of Charity Pulse. We hope that you found our discussion insightful, and certainly opinionated and soapboxy. If you have any questions or topics you'd like us to cover in the future, we would love to hear from you. Don't forget to follow us, leave a review, share our podcast with your network. Join us next time as we continue to explore the challenges and opportunities facing the sector. Until then, keep the pulse of charities beating strong.